ॐ अज्ञानतिमिरान्धस्य ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यमनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपकदा मह्यं दधाति स्वपदान्तिकम्। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरुः श्रीयुतपदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपं साग्रजातं सहगणरघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनसहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। नमो ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामिनिति नामिने। नमस्ते सारस्वतीदेवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेषशून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे। मुकं करोति वाचालं पङ्गुं लङ्घयते गिरिं यत्कृपातमहं वन्दे श्रीगुरून् दीनतारिणम्। वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। नमो महावदान्याय कृष्णप्रेमप्रदायते कृष्णाय कृष्णचैतन्य नामने गौरत्विषे नमः। हे कृष्ण करुणा सिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिका कांत राधाकांत नमोस्तुते। तप्त कांचन गौरांगी राधे वृंदावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये। जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभु नित्यानंद श्री अद्वैत गदाधर श्रीवासादि गौर भक्त वृंद। हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम हरे राम 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 हरे हरे। हरे कृष्णा। सो टुडे इज आवर कंक्लूडिंग लेक्चर ऑन द पास्ट टाइम्स ऑफ लॉर्ड रामचंद्र। वी हैव बीन डिस्कसिंग सो फार वेरियस past times from not only the Valmiki Ramayana but also from other scriptures and also from more recent history. Today we will talk about various pastimes of the Lord where he demonstrated his prowess and valor. When the Lord descends into this material world, he can take many, many different forms, and these are called incarnations. These incarnations seem to appear within the different species of life in this world, sometimes as a fish, sometimes as a swan, and so on. However, he is never to be considered one amongst those species. Although he appears like them, he appears within them, but still he remains in his unique transcendental position as the Supreme Lord. So also when he appears within the human species of life, we should know that at every point in time he remains the Supreme Personality of Godhead. As Srila Prabhupada explains that even when Krishna was a small child in Vrindavan and he was killing Putana or he was performing his childhood pranks, he still was the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Godhead is not a position that can be attained by someone by doing some austerities or by purchasing it with wealth or something like that. Godhead is not a position. Godhead is the absolute reality. So God is, in the sense that Krishna and his incarnations were always God, they are God, and they always will be God. Whatever form they may appear to take, whatever pastime they may be performing, their identity as the personality of Godhead always remains, eternally. And these forms of the Lord also reside, actually they originally reside, in the spiritual world. And to accomplish certain purposes, they descend here from time to time. Each incarnation has his purpose. The major purpose, however, is pleasure, rasa. The Lord is forever seeking to increase his transcendental pleasure, and he also seeks to increase the transcendental pleasure of his devotees. So when he comes in the human species of life, these are, relatively speaking, compared to the other incarnations, more special. Although every incarnation of the Lord performs wonderful pastimes, each incarnation is very beautiful, these pastimes are all sweet, nevertheless, the Naralila, or the pastimes that the Lord performs as a human being, are especially sweet. And in particular, the pastimes of Sri Krishna and Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu are even more so very sweet. Because Lord Ram, the Lord has appeared as Lord Ram, and that's also called Naralila, and there is also so much sweetness in the pastimes of Lord Ramachandra. Although, from the point of view of Tattva, from the point of view of an objective assessment of the relative forms of the Lord, we can see that the pastimes of Krishna are much more full of sweetness, madhurya, than the other avatars. In the activities of Lord Ram, there is some aishwarya, there is some opulence there. The predominance of sweetness is not as much as is in Krishna Leela, but nevertheless, there is a mix of both. Generally, it is considered that when the Lord in Naralila performs activities just as any other human being would do, whether as a child or a grown-up, then that is considered madhurya, madhur, very sweet. And the occasions when he actually displays some superhuman, extraordinary power, that is a display of his opulence, his aishwarya. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that it is a mistaken notion amongst some people that if a pastime of the Lord or if an incarnation of the Lord is to be considered full of madhurya, full of sweetness, then it should be devoid of any display of opulence or some superhuman activity. So Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says that no, this is not so. If that was so, consider Lord Krishna's childhood pastimes. He appeared just like an ordinary child. He was doing all the pranks that any ordinary child would do, and perhaps more. So if Lord Krishna did not perform his acts of opulence even as a child, for example, killing of Putana, killing of Trinavarta and so on, then what would be the difference in the sweetness of the pastimes of Lord Krishna and that of any other ordinary human child? Even the activities of an ordinary human child are found very enchanting by people. People get very attracted to small children's activities. Lord Krishna's pastimes as a child, for example, are especially sweet because they are nourished by an occasional display of opulence. And what is more is that this display of opulence does not diminish in any way the feeling of sweetness experienced by the devotees and by the Lord Himself. On the contrary, they actually increase, they nurture, they nourish that feeling of sweetness. So similarly, Lord Ramachandra, he performs pastimes of some intimacy with his monkey warrior devotees and with so many other devotees, just as an ordinary human being. But then, time to time, he also displays extraordinary superhuman power, which is a display of Aishwarya or his opulence. Of course, we should know that the Lord does this out of his own sweet will, for his and the devotees' pleasure. He may come and sometimes, to please his devotees, take on a human form and then do all these wonderful pastimes. And the power that he displays in these pastimes do not in any way reflect his real capabilities. It's not that when Lord Ramachandra has the bridge built over the sea that he has to undergo so much trouble, or that it exhausts the limits of his power. When a human being does something extraordinary, then at the end of it he is really exhausted. And there comes a time when he cannot do something beyond that limit. But with the Lord, it's not like that. His power, his capability is limitless. That's why he is supreme. He is the Supreme Lord. He is omnipotent. There is nothing that he cannot do. There is nothing impossible for him. But the Lord, according to the circumstance, according to the need, according to the particular pastime that he is enacting at that time, he displays just a tiny, tiny, insignificant portion of his power. And that also is done for the sake of nourishing his pastimes. Now, Lord Ramachandra, when he built the bridge, it is not an extraordinary thing for the Lord to do. What is a few stones? If you float a few stones in the water, for you and me it's something extraordinary. But for the Lord it is not, because he is floating so many huge planets in this space. In the Bhagavad Gita, Lord Krishna says, Gam avishya cha bhutani dharayami aham ojasa. He says, I inspire or infuse every planet, including the earth, in this universe with my ojas shakti, because of which they float in space like cotton swabs, as Prabhupada says. So if the Lord is routinely floating huge bodies of matter, routinely, easily, in all the millions of universes in the creation, is it something very surprising for the Lord to float a few stones on the sea, to make them float on water? It's not something extraordinary. Nevertheless, these pastimes are performed by the Lord and appreciated by the Lord, by the devotees, because the devotees want to see the Lord emerge victorious in all his activities. That is the mood of the devotees. When the Lord's devotees see that the Lord has killed some asura or vanquished some other miscreant, they cheer. We routinely read these in all the descriptions in the Shastras. The demigods, for example, they'll hide behind the clouds because they are afraid of that particular demon. But the Lord is not. And when the Lord has finally dispatched him, then the demigods and the rishis and sages, they applaud, bravo, well done, jaya, 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 very good. So the devotees want to see the Lord victorious and happy. And then they want subject matter like this to keep on talking about, to keep on hearing about and remembering. So pastimes such as the building of the bridge across the sea although it reflects only an infinitesimally small portion of the Lord's pastimes, nevertheless are performed because they eternally celebrate the name and fame and glory of the Lord. So as Lord Ramachandra also, the Lord has performed many of these extraordinary activities which remind us, and especially for those who are faithless, it is a notice to them that yes, the Lord has come as a human being, but please note that He is not a human being. He is the Lord. He performs those activities which even an extraordinary human being cannot do, like Krishna lifting the Govardhan. And for Lord Ramachandra also, he performed many such activities. So today, let us discuss a few of the pastimes that Lord Ramachandra performed, which demonstrate his prowess. When the sage Vishwamitra Muni came to the court of Dasharatha Maharaj and begged for a favor, Dasharatha Maharaj said, "I will offer you anything you like, my kingdom, my wealth, etc." Little did Dasharatha Maharaj realize that Vishwamitra Muni was asking for his son, Sri Ramachandra. Now Dasharatha Maharaj was so attached to Ram that he could not bear the thought of Ram leaving him even for a moment. What to speak of allowing Ram to go with Vishwamitra Muni, because the Muni wanted to have some Rakshasas and demoniac persons killed because they were disturbing the activities of the Rishis in the forest. Dasharatha Maharaj was struck with fear and anxiety. But seeing Vishwamitra Muni's anger at Dasharatha Maharaj's hesitation, and also upon the good advice of Vasishtha Muni, who was the Kula Guru, the family guru of the line of kings, Rajarishis coming in the dynasty of Ikshvaku, Dasharatha Maharaj accepted. Vasishtha Muni, the great sage, he also pacified the king and said, "Don't worry. You are unaware of the prowess of this sage, Vasishtha, or Vishwamitra. Actually, Vishwamitra Muni doesn't need Ram and Lakshman to come and kill the demons. He can easily do it by his Brahma Tejas, by his Brahminical prowess. But he wants to take your son Ram with him just to spread the fame and glory of your son, so that everywhere the name of Ram will be chanted as having been the one to do this good work. And secondly, it is the work of the Kshatriyas to destroy the miscreants. It is not the work of Brahmanas. Therefore, it is appropriate that Ram and Lakshman should come with you." So Dasharatha Maharaj accepted with a heavy heart. Ram and Lakshman very cheerfully and fearlessly accompanied Vishwamitra Muni. It is a fascinating journey for those who would like to read the Valmiki Ramayana. You will see so many fascinating narrations that Valmiki Muni narrates to Ram and Lakshman. He explains the Sthala Mahatmya of each place. Sthala Mahatmya means the particular glories and the history of each place that they stopped at. And even as they were passing by certain places or certain rivers, etc., then Vishwamitra Muni would recount the history of that. This land is called Punya Bhumi not for nothing. Every piece of land here, every hill, every river, every forest, every lake has its own history, going down to old ages. Of course, the forms of many of these hills and rivers and so on have changed over time. But nevertheless, great histories are associated with these places, and they are recorded in our Puranas. And it was a tradition in ancient times that people would, as a duty and as an act of pleasure, hear all these historical narrations. Even the Pandavas, when they were in the forest, they would hear these narrations because they were accompanied by all the sages like Dhaumya and so on. Yudhishthira Maharaj, being the royal sage, being righteousness and dharma personified, was so absorbed in these historical narrations that Draupadi, Bhima and others would get really perturbed and disturbed. And they would urge Maharaj Yudhishthir that you are just absorbed in all these Puranic tales and what about our kingdom? And Yudhishthir Maharaj used to pacify them and say, yes, the time will come, be patient. So Ram and Lakshman also heard all these wonderful Puranic tales from Vishwamitra Muni, who was very, very old. Although he didn't look so old, but he and Vasishtha Muni had lived for many, many years, for many generations. So, in the course of the travels, Vishwamitra Muni showed them many things, and they came to the point where two rivers were meeting, and there was a huge sound, tumultuous sound coming. Ram and Lakshman asked, what is this sound that we are hearing? Then Vishwamitra Muni explained that long ago, the creator of this universe, Brahma, created a lake from his own mind. And that lake was called the Manasa, because it comes from the Manaha, from the mind of Brahma, so it became the Manasa. And it is there in the region of Kailas. Today, the equivalent, that is, of this lake to our ordinary vision, in our dimension of reality, is called the Manasarovar. Has anyone been to Manasarovar, which is in present-day Tibet? It is a fascinating journey. It has certain kind of beauty which is indescribable over there, serene. And many, many rishis and sages still live there. And the Chinese authorities actually permit these sages to live there. Although ordinarily, because there is some tension politically always between China, India, all these things, these factors are there. But these sages are allowed by even the Chinese military to do their work. They just sit there in cold ice, even in winter, and they do their tapasya and so on. So, the river Saryu emanates from this Manasarovar, Manasa lake. Saraso yati iti Saryu. So from, because it is emanated from the lake, therefore it is called Saryu. The word Saras, Sarayaha in Sanskrit means lake. So the river Saryu then flows down into the plains, and at a certain point it meets the Ganges as she comes down from the Himalayas. And the point where Vishwamitra Muni and Ram and Lakshman were was the confluence of these two rivers. And when they met, there was a huge crashing sound of their waters. Very beautiful and scenic spot. Then they crossed the river, came to the southern side of the Ganga, and thereupon they entered a forest which was very, very dense and very fierce. There were sounds of the birds and animals which were very fierce and fearful. There were thorns everywhere and bushes and so on. And Ram asked Vishwamitra, what is this forest that we can see here? Why does it look so fierce and why is there such a vibration about this place? So then Vishwamitra Muni explained that there is a history associated with this place. Long ago, Indra killed Vritrasura. The Vritra, we read this in the Srimad Bhagavatam also, the sixth canto. Vritra was born in a Brahmanic, in a family of a Brahmana. So therefore, even though he was of an Asuric nature, of course we know Vritrasura was also a great devotee of Lord Vishnu. So the sin of killing a Brahmana came upon Indra. And he had to bear the impurities that came upon him as a result of that. So upon consulting with the sages, they suggested certain methods of purification and atonement for that sin of killing Brahmana. So then he was bathed with the holy waters of the Ganges. Many sacred mantras were chanted and rituals were performed by the sages. And in this way, Indra became free from the reactions of that sin. Now, the impurities that were washed off from Indra were deposited by Indra in this particular tract of land. And Indra became now purified again. But being pleased upon the land for having accepted his impurities, he also granted a boon. And he said that these two places, which will be called Malada and Karusha, will attain great prosperity and they will be very beautiful. And so the demigods applauded Indra's benediction upon this land. And then Vishwamitra continued that this land continued to be prosperous with bountiful stocks of food grains and natural beauty, till one time a Rakshasi, an ogress called Tataka, came here to reside. She was of very fierce aspect. She was a man-eater, Rakshasi, cannibal. And she had a very hideous form, very ugly to look at. And she has a strength of 1,000 elephants. And she ranges the forest, she roams around in the forest here, along with her son, Marij. She is the wife of the Asura called Sunda. So, O dear Ram, this Tataka must be killed. So Ram was hearing about this particular lady, and Vishwamitra definitely felt that there was some hesitation on the part of Ram, because now he was being asked to kill a lady. So for a Kshatriya to kill a lady, you know, there is some problem there. Like Bhishma also we see, you know, when Shikhandi came forward, because this was Krishna's ploy, Krishna's strategy. And I think it was Amba from the previous life who now became Shikhandi. And Krishna asked Arjuna to put Shikhandi in front, and when Bhishma saw Shikhandi, he put down his weapons. He said, how can I fight and kill a lady? It's against the dharma of the Kshatriya. And in any case, the Shastra said that the woman is amongst the five categories who must be protected, not killed. So Vishwamitra sensed that some thoughts like this must be going on in Ram's mind. So he began to narrate the history of Tataka. And Ram had also asked the question that generally women are physically less powerful than men. We have heard of men having the strength of 1,000 elephants and so on. But here is a lady. How is it that she has acquired so much power? So then Vishwamitra explained that there was a yaksha called Suketu. He was issueless without a child for many, many years. And he, with severe austerities, propitiated Brahmaji. Finally, Brahmaji appeared before him and he said, all right, since you are without issue, I know the desires in your mind, so I will grant you the benediction that you will get a child, but it will be a female child. But this female child will have the strength of 1,000 elephants. So then a child, a baby girl, was born, and she was called Tataka. She was extremely beautiful to look at, and she was also very, very powerful. She had the strength of 1,000 elephants, as Brahma had benedicted. Soon she came of age, and her father Suketu married her to Sunda, who was an Asura from the Asura race. But because the Yakshas and Asuras are both superhuman, something like the demigod platform, so that marriage was okay, it was all right. So they got married. Now what happened was that Sunda was cursed by Agastya Muni to die for some offense that Sunda had done. When Tataka heard of this, she was enraged and she rushed towards Agastya Muni along with her son Maricha to kill him. Agastya Muni was very, very powerful. Some of you may have heard of his various pastimes, of how he displayed his Brahmanical Tejas. At another time there were the two demons, Ila and Vitapa, who wanted to kill him. And one of them said that we'll change into the form of a lamb and we'll become his food. And when we go inside his stomach, then we will open his stomach and tear it open from inside. And Agastya was very intelligent, he understood, he digested the food. He ate it, digested everything, so that he killed the demon. So he was so powerful. So there are many, many stories like this about Agastya. So Agastya, he saw this lady, beautiful young lady, approaching with her son, and he cursed her just with his hunkar. You see, in the old days, the Brahmanical Tejas was so powerful, just by the hunkar, they could destroy, you know, so many fierce warriors and asuras and so on, just like Vishwamitra had done in the days of yore. I beg your pardon, Vasishtha has done with the armies of Vishwamitra. So Agastya Muni cursed her that because you are coming with such an evil intention towards me, a Brahmana, a sage, therefore I curse you that you will become a Rakshasi, an ogress, and also that you will become very, very ugly and hideous to look at. And so shall your son Maricha also. Now she was suddenly transformed into a very ugly, huge Rakshasi. And her son, Marich, was also very ugly to look at, and he was very round, and he had the strength like the strength of Indra. And out of her sheer frustration at having been so transformed, she was roaming around this forest. And because of that, no one used to come to that region. And she moved in a direction of 12 miles this way and that way off the road. And she would kill and eat anyone who would come there. So since the time of this Tataka, this place has become so horrible. And Ram, Vishwamitra continued, if you are thinking in your mind that it is against dharma to kill a woman, please know for a fact that for the sake of protection, those upon whom the burden of administration has been placed, killing even a woman is not adharmic, it is not irreligious. Sometimes, for the sake of protecting the people at large, the administrators may even have to do something that is sinful, because that is their duty. And also in the past, my dear Ram, there are instances of ladies having been killed because they were a source of great trouble to the world at large. There was one lady whose name was Manthara. This is not the Manthara who was the maidservant of Kaikeyi, it's another Manthara. She was the daughter of Virochan. Virochan was the son of who? Prahlad Maharaj. So Prahlad Maharaj's son was Virochan, and he had a daughter called Manthara. And she was very evil. And somehow Indra then had to kill her in order to perform his service of protection. Similarly, Vishwamitra Muni explained that the wife of Bhrigu, or rather the daughter of Bhrigu, who was the wife of Shukracharya, who was the Kula Guru of the Asuras, she also developed an inimical attitude towards Lord Vishnu, and Lord Vishnu personally killed her. So therefore, Ram, this lady is not an ordinary lady who is to be protected. So go forth and kill her. So Ram, then inspired by the words of Vishwamitra Muni, stood there with his legs apart and twanged his powerful bow. It created a very loud sound which reverberated throughout the whole forest. Tataka was living in this forest with her companions, who were also equally fierce Rakshasis and Rakshasas. They all got very fearful upon hearing this sound. And Tataka in particular was very much enraged. And she came forward thinking, who is this person who dares to come into my forest and disturb my peaceful forest, peaceful from her point of view, my peaceful life here in this forest? So she came and she saw Ram. And then a fierce battle took place. She was an expert at conjuring tricks, at magic tricks. And for the first 1 hour, she was simply showering all kinds of dust and rocks and so on at Ram and Lakshman. And even though Ram and Lakshman were shooting arrows, but they were covered from everywhere, from all sides. And finally, when this was going on, Vishwamitra again gently cajoled Ram. Oh Ram, be done with your tenderness. Now, kill her quickly. Because twilight is approaching, and you know that the Rakshasas become very powerful when it becomes dark. So then, Ram took this hint. He picked up his bow and arrow, and then shot an arrow straight into the chest of Tataka. And she fell to the ground with a loud cry, and she died. And in this way, Lord Ram accomplished the purposes of the sages. The sages were all very happy. The demigods also were very happy. And they all applauded Lord Ramachandra, and they were showering flowers and praising his glorious activities. In this way, Lord Ramachandra killed Tataka and delivered her. Because everyone who is killed by the Lord is also delivered by the Lord. Because the Lord is absolute, there is no difference between his killing and his loving. Because whatever he does for the welfare of others, of the living entities. So Vishwamitra Muni, being very happy, they proceeded further on to the destination of Siddhashram, which was the ashram of Vishwamitra. And they began to perform their yajñas. And this asura, this rakshasa called Maricha, and his friends like Subahu and so on, they used to come every time Vishwamitra Muni and the sages were getting ready to perform yajñas, and they would pollute it just at the critical time when the yajña was about to reach its completion. They would come at that time, and then they would pollute it with all kinds of foul substances. So this time Ram and Lakshman, they stood on guard with their bows and arrows in hand. When they were standing guard, they were not like the chowkidars and the watchmen that we usually know, who generally fall asleep. But they were guarding very, very nicely, very alert. And after many days had gone by, then, sure enough, there came Maricha, Subahu, and all these horrible Rakshasas. They came in flying through the sky. These Rakshasas are usually endowed with superhuman powers and yogic siddhis. Sometimes they are called Khechari. The Rakshasis are called Khechara or Khechari. K means the space, and they travel through the space. All these stories that we can find in the land, in different lands, of witches flying on broomsticks and so on, they are not actually so mythical as we may think, because these Rakshasis did exist in history, like Tataka and her companions and followers. Putana was also a Khechari, Prabhupada explains in the Srimad Bhagavatam in his purport, that there were those who would fly on their broomsticks and travel. As children we may have read all these things in comics, but actually they have some basis in reality. So anyway, Maricha and Subahu and all of them came, and again a fierce battle took place, and Lord Ramachandra, with one sharp arrow, he threw Maricha 800 miles away. That is 100 yojanas away. And Maricha was thrown off, and he was flung into the distance. He didn't know what had happened to him. Now, much later, you see, Maricha never came back here to this place. Once was enough. So he never came back. Much, much later, when Shurpanakha, after her having been insulted and humiliated by Ram and Lakshman, and after Ram had killed the 14,000 Rakshasas at Janasthan, Shurpanakha had gone howling to Ravan and taunting him that he was just a useless coward, he had no strength, he was just a make-believe warrior. He was really taunting him. And then he came forward, "All right, let me see what I can do about this Sita. I will kidnap Sita." And then the first person he thought about was his old friend Maricha, who was living a peaceful, contented life, almost like a sage in the forest. His experience with Ram had been enough for him. And he was now living in the forest all alone. And Ravana somehow came to know. And then he approached Maricha. And he said, Maricha, I have an errand for you. I have a job for you to perform. He said, what is that? I want you to kidnap, to help me to kidnap Sita. She is very, very beautiful and she has become the object of my desire. So I want you to do this, this, this and this. He laid out a whole plan for him. Maricha was shocked. And Maricha started preaching to Ravana. He said, you do not know who this Ram is. Let me tell you what he did to me. And then he recounted his horror story of what experience he had. And he said, you don't know. With one arrow he sent me 800 miles away. And every time even the name of Ram is mentioned, I tremble in fear. Please don't even mention this. Don't even think about this. I advise you, my dear friend Ravan, stay away if you want to live. But this inspired Ravana more and more. And he got angry. Chanakya Pandit said that when a foolish person is given good advice, he gets angry. Just as a serpent, his poison increases when he's fed with nice milk. And Ravan told him, my dear Maricha, you have two choices. One is possible death at the hands of Ram. You are fearing that, isn't it? You are fearing that Ram may kill you. So that's one option for you. Possible death at the hands of Ram. And the second option is certain death at my hands. Make your choice. So Maricha didn't have much of a choice. So he made his choice. And then we know the history. He took on the form of a golden deer and so on. And he was responsible. Ultimately, he was killed. But at least he was killed at the hands of the Lord. Maricha thought like that. I know I will have to die at Ram's hands. But better to die at Ram's hands than to die at Ravan's hands. And so in this way, Maricha was not killed by Ram for this purpose. If Ram had wanted, he could have killed Maricha with that one arrow. But he didn't. He let him live for performing this pastime at a future date. And then his companion Subahu, he killed him on the spot. And in this way, Lord Ram and Lakshman, they killed many, many of these vicious Rakshasas who were inhabiting these areas and were creating such a nuisance for all the peaceful ascetics who were living there performing their austerities. So Vishwamitra Muni was very, very happy. From his heart, he and the other sages blessed Ram and Lakshman. And they said, Ram, there is one more thing I want you to do now, which is something very pleasant. All the unpleasant things are over now. I want you to come with me to Mithila, where the great king Janaka is residing. And he has a very beautiful daughter called Sita. And I wish that you participate in the Swayamvara ceremony, by which you will become eligible to marry this beautiful daughter of King Janaka, who is just suitable for you. And this King Janaka, he has his bow, which is there, and he has an open challenge to anyone who can lift that bow. Only he will be eligible to marry his daughter. So Ram said, as you desire. So they all proceeded. Again, there is a beautiful description of some historical narrations of each place as they go on. Finally, they arrive at Mithila. And in Mithila, when Janak Maharaj hears that Vishwamitra Muni is coming, then he is very happy. He comes out of his city with his ministers and his sages, and he welcomes Vishwamitra Muni. And you see, in the Vedic times, there was a lot of formality involved in everything. Things weren't so informal. There was a certain process and etiquette of welcome. It had to be a long speech of welcome, and then everybody would patiently hear that. then there would be mutual glorification. And then when the kings met, especially the time of when they were marrying off their children to each other, then they would recount their dynasty, you know, their genealogy right from the beginning, that this is my, you know, a dynasty that's coming here, and I offer my son to your daughter. And then the daughter's father would recount his genealogy, that this is my dynasty. So both dynasties are very appropriate. So we can, it's an apt match. In this way, so many formalities have to take place. And Valmiki Muni recounts all of these formalities that took place. And then the time came, and King Janak said, these two boys whom you have here with you, Vishwamitra ji, they seem like demigods who have descended from the higher planets. They look like veritable tigers and bulls amongst men. Look at their lotus eyes, and look at their various comely features. They do not seem like ordinary young men to me. So what desire do they have? What service can I do for them? And then Vishwamitra Muni explained that they desire to see the famous bow that you have. And then King Janak said, yes, but this bow is very difficult to even lift. Now let me recount to you, O great sage, the history of this bow. Once upon a time, Daksha Prajapati had organized a big yajna. And somehow or the other, out of envy, he did not invite Lord Shiva, his son-in-law. Now we have also heard this pastime from the Srimad Bhagavatam. Then Lord Shiva, in great anger, picked up his personal bow. And he put an arrow to it, and he was about to kill everybody in that assembly, including Daksha Prajapati. At that time, all the gods, the demigods, came to him and begged him not to create this great havoc throughout the higher worlds. Lord Shiva was pacified, and then he gave the bow, that was his personal bow, Lord Shiva's bow, he gave it to the gods, the demigods. The demigods in turn gave it to Maharaj Nimi. Now, as we were discussing a day or two ago, that King Ikshvaku was the founder of the Ayodhya city. He was the first ruler of Ayodhya. And he also had other sons. Through Vishal, the one line came in, and through Nimi, another line came in. So he said that my forefather was the great King Nimi. The gods gave it to King Nimi, and through him, the generations of kings coming down have preserved this bow very, very carefully. Now this bow is in my possession, Lord Shiva's bow. And I wish to tell you, O great sage, that some years ago, while performing a sacrifice, I was performing the ritual of plowing the sacrificial ground. And lo and behold, I found over there in the furrow of the plowshare, that means in the ground, the depression that is made when the plow moves through the ground, I saw this most beautiful young child. And she was there, golden complexion, endowed with all divine characteristics on her body. And I accepted her as the gift of the Lord. I picked her up and took her as my daughter. And therefore I called her Sita. In Sanskrit, the word Sita means the furrow of a plowshare. That means the space that is in the mud, on the earth, that is created by the plow. So she was called Sita. Very soon, she grew up. She came of age earlier than her time. And she was extremely beautiful. And I was thinking that only the worthiest among the Kshatriyas is eligible to marry her. Many great kings and powerful warriors from everywhere came and petitioned me many times for her hand in marriage. But I said no. Only the most valorous of the kings can do that. And then the kings came and asked me, what was the standard I had set to test their prowess? And then I told them that I want them to lift this bow of Lord Shiva, toss it in their palms to judge its weight, and then to string this bow. And many, many great kings came. They tried, but they could not even lift that bow of Lord Shiva. In fact, O dear Muni, many Gandharvas, Yakshas and residents of the higher planets have come and tried, and even they have failed. And although I see these two young lads, Ram and Lakshman, endowed with all kinds of good qualities and looking very powerful, but I doubt, how can they lift this bow when even the residents of the higher planets have not been able to do so? But nevertheless, let them also have their try. So King Janak, in his heart, he had hoped that Ram would have been able to lift this bow. Because immediately he understood that if at all there was a good match for his daughter, it was him, Lord Ram. But then it was a question of his word and his honor. So unless Ram was able to lift the bow, he would not be able to marry Sita. So then Vishwamitra said, "My dear son, please go ahead." Ram bowed low before Vishwamitra Muni and strode very confidently like an elephant, went to the bow, and very casually he put his left hand in the middle of the bow and lifted it. He seized the bow and lifted it very easily. And then in no time he had strung the bow, and then he took hold of the bow and broke it in half. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, Shukadev Goswami says that this is Bala Gaja Leelaha. Bala Gaja means a baby elephant. Just as a baby elephant moves into a farm or an agricultural field where there are stalks of sugarcane and very easily breaks these sticks of sugarcane in play. Similarly, Lord Ramachandra easily, as if in sport, he lifted this effortlessly, strung it and cracked the bow. Now the noise, the sound that emanated from the cracking of this bow was so terrible that it let loose an earthquake, a huge earthquake. And the sound was so deafening that everyone who was assembled there, except King Janak, Vishwamitra Muni and Ram and Lakshman, except for these four, everyone else fell to the ground. And they were wondering what was happening. And then finally, when everyone came to the realization of what had happened, then there were shouts of victory and jai, jai and so on. And all the demigods from the higher planets, the Gandharvas, the Siddhas, the Vidyadharas and Kinnaras and so on, they all started showering flowers from the skies. And in this way, Janak Maharaj was extremely pleased. And he said, "Oh my dear king, this is a very fortunate day for us. Let us now solemnize the marriage of Sita and Ram without any further waste of time. So please permit me to send my messengers to Ayodhya to inform the good king Dasharath about this and to invite him here." And so, with the proper protocol and the proper dignity as was befitting a king like Dasharath Maharaj, a retinue of counselors and messengers went on behalf of Janak. They conveyed the good tidings to Maharaj Dasharath. Dasharath Maharaj was very happy. He came immediately with his counselors and so on. And again, the meeting of the two kings is described by Valmiki Muni very, very in great detail. Finally, the marriage took place. And all the four brothers were married to the four daughters. Janak Maharaj, his real name was Shiradhvaja. Janak was actually a title that was given to the kings who came in the line of Maharaj Nimi. There were many Janakas. And this Janak was Shiradhvaja. He had two daughters, Sita, and the other was Urmila. So Urmila was married to Lakshman, while Sita was married to Ram. Shiradhvaja had a younger brother called Kushadhvaja. Kushadhvaja also had two daughters whose names were Mandavi and Shrutakirti. Mandavi was married to Bharat and Shrutakirti was married to Shatrughna. In this way, this grand marriage ceremony took place. And finally, after King Janak had given a huge dowry of many, many lakhs of cows and elephants and maids and silken cloth and so many things, Maharaj Dashrath took his permission to leave. And he departed towards Ayodhya. In this way, the story of the breaking of Lord Shiva's bow has been narrated by Valmiki Muni in the Ramayana. A humorous story comes to mind at this time, in connection with Lord Shiva's bow. It's a modern story. It's a satirical story reflecting the state of the modern educational system. One time, in India, one school inspector who was appointed by the government, he went to one particular school and he was giving a speech to the students. And he said, "So my dear children, you are all very bright students, I am going to ask you a question. How many of you have read the Ramayana?" Everyone put up their hands. "Yes, yes, yes, we have heard the Ramayana." "Very good. So now tell me, who broke the bow of Lord Shiva?" So there was complete silence everywhere. And then suddenly, after a few minutes of silence, one boy from the back, he raised his hand. "Sir, sir, not me, not me, I didn't break it, I didn't break it." So the school inspector was very surprised. He looked at the teacher who was sitting there, as if to say, "What is this?" And then the teacher looked equally bewildered, and then he stuttered and stammered for a few moments, and then he said, "Sir, sir, I know, this boy has done it. He is the one who has broken the bow. I know it." So now the school inspector was even more bewildered. So now he looked at the principal. The principal was also now stuttering and stammering. Now what to do, what to say? He said, "Finally, sir, whatever it may be, whoever may have broken it, we'll adjust it in our budget in the school. We'll..." So this is just a satirical story I heard from one devotee one time, just talking about the modern educational system. You know, of course, nowadays they don't teach them anything in the schools about Ramayana, Mahabharata, Srimad Bhagavatam and so on. They only teach them secular knowledge, thinking that this is the way of advancement and progress in life. So anyway, this was the history of how Lord Shiva's bow was broken. But there was another bow which Lord Ram broke. Does anybody know? Which bow? Yeah, but who was the bow actually belonging to? Whose bow was it? Lord Vishnu's bow. And that was being carried by Parshuram. And that happened soon after this incident. And that also is narrated by Valmiki Muni. When Dashrath Maharaj, very, very happy at heart, was now on his way back to Ayodhya, along with his sons and daughters-in-law, and his ministers and warriors and so on, suddenly at one point, there were all kinds of omens. Some creatures and birds were making very horrible sounds. At the same time, Dashrath Maharaj noticed that the deer, the animals were passing them, all of them were passing them on their left side, from their left. So Dashrath Maharaj inquired from Vasishtha Muni that, "My dear sage, what do these omens indicate?" So Vasishtha Muni thoughtfully replied, he said, "My dear king, these fearful sounds being created by the owls and the other animals and birds indicates some disaster. Something very fearful is going to happen. But at the same time, because the deer are passing all of us on our left side, therefore it means there is nothing to worry." So just at that moment, suddenly a very fierce storm came up. And lashing winds, and everything became enveloped in darkness. The sun seemed to be covered. Dark clouds came there. Shrieking sounds were being heard from all around. And there was cold breeze, and suddenly everyone there was perplexed. What is this? What's going on? And a dust storm came up, and all of them were covered with dust. They could not see the different directions even. And just at that time, in the middle of this darkness, through the dust, towards Dasharatha Maharaj and Lord Ramachandra, came one sage who looked very fierce. His features, his expression was very fierce. And he had matted locks on his hair. He had an axe that he was carrying on one shoulder. And he also had a big, huge bow and arrow set that he was carrying with his other arm. He was clothed in deer skin. And he looked to be very austere. And as he came, everyone chanted below their breath, "Oh, Parshuram! Parshuram has come." All the sages who were accompanying this royal retinue huddled amongst themselves and said, "Oh, it looks like he is so angry now. Has he decided that he wants to break his vow of peace and again start annihilating the Kshatriyas? Because you know that Parshuram had annihilated the Kshatriyas in the world 21 times over. And after he had done this, because he had been responsible for so much bloodshed, he had to atone for the sin. So he performed a huge sacrifice in which the sage Kashyap was the chief priest. And after the sacrifice was performed, it is the duty of the Yajaman, or the person on whose behalf the sacrifice is performed, to give Dakshina to the priest. And generally it was the custom that everything you owned was to be given to the priest. When Dasharatha Maharaj performed the Yajna, he gave everything to the priest, the whole planet, because Dasharatha Maharaj was the king of the whole planet. So he whole earth he gifted to the sages. And then it was a routine thing. And then the sages said, "My dear king, we are Brahmanas. What do we need dominion over the earth for? We are simply happy doing our austerities in the forest. So here, we give back in charity the earth to you." And then Dasharatha Maharaj took back the kingdom and began to rule. Does anyone do anything like this now? Anything we can conceive in the modern age? First of all, nobody will give like that. Very few will give in charity like that. Very few. And even if someone by mistake makes an offer, "Take all my wealth," the person will gladly take it and not return it. But the Brahmanas took that in charity and they happily returned it. Because they knew, what do we have to do with all this wealth? The Brahmanas' wealth is their poverty. The Brahmanas' wealth is their austerity. So they have no need for all these things. So then, having destroyed the Kshatriyas 21 times over, Parshuram basically was the lord of the earth. So that was his wealth. So he gave it to Kashyap Muni. And Kashyap Muni then gave it to the other kings. And he said, "Now, since this is my earth, it is my property, I ask that you do not come and live here on this earth anymore. You go and do your tapasya somewhere." So, Lord Parshuram, he retired to Mount Mahindra to live there. And he was performing his austerities over there. But now, when they all saw him again coming down with the bow and the axe and everything, everyone started getting disturbed, thinking, now what is in his mind? So the sages received Parshuram very nicely. In the meanwhile, of course, Vishwamitra Muni, by the way, had already left for his ashram. So he was not in this group here. Because Vishwamitra Muni is an ancestor of Parshuram. Let me see if I remember the relationship. Vishwamitra Muni, he is a son of Gadhi Rishi. Gadhi Rishi had two children as far as I can remember. One was Vishwamitra, and he also had a sister. Now the sister was given in marriage the great sage Richika. And Richika, his son was Jamadagni, and Jamadagni's son was Parshuram. So now you see whatever is the relationship. So Parshuram's father, his uncle was Vishwamitra Muni. So that's the relation. So Vishwamitra Muni was senior, far senior to Parshuram from the worldly connection. So had he been there, Parshuram would not have been able to come there. So in order to facilitate the pastimes of the Lord inspired Vishwamitra Muni from within to leave that group earlier and go back to his ashram. So Parshuram came. He was happy to be received by the sages very nicely. And then he straight away started speaking to Lord Ramachandra. He said, "Oh Ram, I have heard all the details about the most extraordinary feat that you have performed in breaking the bow of Lord Shiva. I admire your prowess. But now I have another bow here. This is the bow of Lord Vishnu. And I am asking you now to doubly prove your prowess in front of me by stringing this bow. And after you have succeeded in doing that, I challenge you to a single combat with me." Dashrath Maharaj was very, very unhappy to hear this. He became extremely nervous. And he came in front of Parshuram with folded hands. "My dear sage, you are coming in the line of the sage Bhrigu. You are the son of Bhargava Rishi, I think. So you are coming in this most famous dynasty that is known for mercy. And are you bent upon destroying all of us? Because Ram is so dear to my heart that if you kill Ram, then I will not be able to live. Ram is our life and soul. You have given your promise to Indra, O great sage, that you will not take up weapons again. Why then have you come here, bent upon our destruction? Please have mercy upon us and leave my young lad alone. He is only a boy of 16 years old." Because Dashrath Maharaj knew the prowess of Parshuram. But Parshuram was not in the mood to listen. He completely ignored Dashrath Maharaj as if Dashrath Maharaj didn't exist. He continued to speak to Ram. "Oh Ram, let me tell you the history of the two bows." And now at this point, Parshuram gives a slightly different history of Lord Shiva's bow. When Janak Maharaj was reciting it, he said that the bow's history was related to the Daksha Yajna. But now Parshuram has a different story to tell. And he says that one time when the demon Tripura was there and Lord Shiva had killed him, and upon killing this demon, then Lord Shiva gave over this bow to the demigods. The demigods in turn gave it to Maharaj Nimi, and then it has come down. So slightly different story. But there is another bow, Ram, which is as powerful as the bow of Rudra, and that is Lord Vishnu's bow. And let me tell you the history of that. This bow was given personally to my ancestor, Richika, Rishi Richika. Because he was a peaceful sage, he had nothing to do with it. And my father Jamadagni, he also was a peaceful ascetic. He had taken a vow that he would never retaliate against anyone who did any harm to him. As it happened, we find the narration in the Srimad Bhagavatam also, that the king Sahasrarjun, because he had 100 arms, 100 heads. He had 100 arms. So he had killed Jamadagni. And Parshuram was so enraged at this that he had gone around killing the Kshatriyas 21 times. And he said, because of this, now the bow is lying in my possession. I had taken to the Kshatriya Vritti, even though I am a Brahmana, and I had killed many, many Kshatriyas. I had made use of these weapons. And now this bow is lying here with me. So I am asking you, O Ram, to lift this bow. Take it and string it if you have your prowess still intact. Lord Ram, he replied, thus far, O great sage, I have kept quiet. But I can see that you are not aware of my prowess. So now I will display to you my prowess. And he very casually seized the bow of Lord Vishnu from Parshuram. In the Padma Puran it is mentioned that in this act of seizing the bow, because that required a lot of strength and energy to seize the bow, but simultaneously the Purana says he was very humble about it. He did it in such a sweet way that Parshuram didn't even notice the thing getting taken away from him. Very nice, sweetly, he took away the whole thing very humbly, although it required a lot of energy. He took it away. And it's also described in the Padma Puran that as he took away the bow, he also took away Parshuram's Shakti. Now sometimes the question may come that after all Parshuram is also considered an avatar. Ram is an avatar too, so here we have two avatars fighting. But actually this is a pastime meant to glorify Lord Ramachandra. Lord Ramachandra is full Vishnu Tattva, whereas Parshuram is Shaktyavesh avatar. These are avatars who are empowered by the Supreme Lord with certain specific powers to fulfill a specific purpose. The power that Parshuram had was called Dushta Damana Shakti, which means the Shakti or power to subdue the miscreants. Just like Prithu Maharaj had the Prajapalana Shakti, the Shakti to maintain the Praja or the subjects and so on. So he took away this power from Parshuram. And Parshuram was speechless. He was just gazing at Ram as he strung the bow. And then he fixed an arrow to it and he stretched the string and said, now my dear sage, please tell me, where should I release this bow? Should I release it in a direction that will completely stop your freedom to move within the three worlds? Or with this arrow, should I stop and take away your rising to the higher planets as a result of the austerities you have performed? Now, as you know, on the earth planet, when we perform certain pious activities, punya, we can rise at the most to Swargaloka. Generally, that is the aspiration of Karmakandis. They want to go to Swargaloka to enjoy certain opulences and higher heavenly pleasures. But those who are ascetics and sages, who are very deeply involved in meditation and austerities, they ascend to the planets which are even higher than Swarga, like Maharloka, Janaloka, Tapaloka and so on. So it seems that Parashuram, by virtue of his meditation, his austerities and so on, was destined to go to those higher planets. But Ram said that you have a choice. Either with this, when I release this bow, I stop your freedom of movement within the three worlds, or I take away all the credits that you have because of your austerities. So you will not be able to attain to the higher planets. Which do you want? And Parshuram, he was now completely humble and he bowed his hands, he bent low, he bowed down and with folded hands said, now my dear Lord, I understand that you are none other than Lord Vishnu himself. It is my great fortune that I have come before you. Please do not take away my access to travel within the three worlds, but take away my ascending to the higher planets. In other words, Parshuram said, take away the credits that have come as a result of my performing austerities. So I don't have to go to Maharloka, Janaloka or any of these lokas. And then Ram let loose the arrow. And Parshuram, he said, now, my dear Lord, please give me the permission to depart. I am not embarrassed or ashamed that you have defeated me. On the contrary, I am now happy, because it is none other than my worshipable Lord who has defeated me. In the same way, as when Lord Shiva was defeated by Vishnu, Lord Shiva was happy to be defeated. In fact, this is part of the history of Lord Vishnu's bow. That one time, the demigods were talking amongst themselves of who is superior, Vishnu or Shiva. And Brahmaji somehow created a situation where Lord Vishnu and Lord Shiva got into a battle. And Lord Shiva came out with his bow. And Lord Vishnu just simply with his humkar, he just defeated Lord Shiva, who swooned unconscious. And then all the demigods understood that it is Vishnu who is supreme. And that's how then Vishnu's bow was given down the generations, and that came to Parashuram. So Parashuram at this stage, with all humility, he glorified Lord Ramachandra and said, I must hurry now, because I have given my vow to Kashyap Muni that I will not spend a night on the plains. I have to go back to Mount Mahindra to perform my austerities. And thus Lord Ram gave him permission and Parashuram departed. Dashrath Maharaj, because of his anxiety at the possibility of Parshuram defeating and killing Ram, he had gone into such a trance of anxiety, of sorrow, that he had not noticed anything that had happened thereafter. He had not noticed how Ram had snatched the bow, how Ram had strung it, how Parshuram had begged forgiveness from Lord Ramachandra. Then Lord Ram very sweetly told his father, my dear father, Parshuram has left and everything is well and I think we should go back. And Dashrath Maharaj said, oh, he has left. Okay, good, let us go now. So Dashrath Maharaj was completely oblivious to this whole thing that went on afterwards. So anxious was he was so absorbed in love for his own son. He didn't even realize what was happening there, what dialogue was going on between Parashuram and Ram. So one lesson we can learn is that whatever Shakti is given to living entities is given by the Supreme Lord, and it's given for a purpose. And that purpose is that this Shakti must be exclusively used in the service of the Lord for His glorification alone. If anyone misuses that Shakti for his own pleasure or own sense gratification, or misuses that Shakti and redirects it against the Lord Himself, the Lord will very easily take away that Shakti. What to speak of ordinary living entities? He did that even to Parshuram, who was so powerful that he annihilated the Kshatriyas 21 times over in this world. So in this way, finally, Lord Ramachandra and his brothers along with their wives and Maharaj Dashrath and all the great sages like Vasishtha, etc., they reached back to Ayodhya. So these are some of the examples that of Lord Ramachandra's exhibition of valor before his period of exile. Even in his period of exile, Lord Ramachandra demonstrated many, many such superhuman activities. I will just narrate one, but there are several more, but time, let us see how much time we have. In about 10 or 15 minutes more, we'll try to see we can narrate one more pastime. When Lord Ramachandra made friendship with Sugriva in Kishkindha, Kshetra, Sugriv was very happy because it was mutually beneficial to both. And Sugriva's agenda was that his elder brother, Vali, should be killed. And Sugriv was very, very fearful of Vali. And Lord Ramachandra lived for some time with Sugriva, and they were planning how to kill Vali. Sugriva was explaining the prowess of Vali. He said that one time, this is described in another part of the Ramayana, that one time Ravana, full of intoxication of his power and strength, was roaming all over the universe challenging anyone who he thought was worthy of challenge. Because he thought he was the most powerful person in the whole creation. And he was really puffed up. So he would challenge everyone and defeat them. So one time he came to Kishkindha. This was the time when Vali was the king. And he said, "Where is the king? I want to challenge him to combat." And Sugriva, Angad and the others, they sensed the pride of Ravan and they said, "My dear king, you can just wait for a few hours and King Vali will be back. But nevertheless, if you are really keen to meet your death very soon, then we will direct you to where he is right now. And he is presently doing his sandhya vandana, his prayers, on the southern sea, on the shore of the southern sea, the four corners of the earth where the seas are." You see, Vali every day used to go to the four corners of the globe. He'd do his prayers, his Gayatri prayers and other prayers, mantras at each of the four corners. He would jump and then come back to Kishkindha. So Ravan, he jumped over there, he went straight to the southern seas, and sure enough, he saw Vali sitting over there in deep meditation, chanting his mantras. And Ravan parked his chariot behind, and he was stealthily approaching Vali from behind, very secretly. But Vali somehow or other happened to notice this movement, but he was very clever. So he did not give an indication that he had seen Ravan. So Ravan was coming quietly, and Vali was completely chanting and didn't give the slightest hint. So Ravan was unsuspecting. He came, the moment Ravan came behind him, Vali immediately caught hold of Ravana's neck and put it under his armpit. And Ravan was fiercely fighting, he was scratching and he was punching. But Vali was completely not bothered. And he had finished chanting his mantras at the southern sea, now he had to go to the eastern sea. So he jumped with Ravan's head still under his armpit. He jumped to the eastern sea, and even as Ravana was still struggling and kicking and punching, he finished his chanting of mantras over there. Again he jumped to the northern sea, and then to the western sea, and then in this way he went to the whole earth, and flying through the skies, Ravan was there hanging under his armpits. And everyone was looking amazed, what is going on, who is this? And finally Vali let him loose when Ravana begged for forgiveness. And then Ravana forged a pact of friendship with Vali. He said, "Now I have understood your power, O great king. Please accept me as your friend." So Vali was a Kshatriya, since now Ravana had begged forgiveness and surrendered, so he said, "All right." And there was a fire, and in front of the fire they forged a pact of friendship. They came back. So Sugriva knew this. So Sugriva had described also this part. And then he said another, he gave another narration of Vali's power. One time he killed this asura whose name was Mayavat, something like that. And he killed him. And his brother, Dundubhi, had also approached to avenge that killing. And Vali engaged in very severe combat with him. And at the end of it, Vali defeated him. And he threw his dead body 4 miles away. and it landed in the ashram of a sage called Matanga. Matanga Muni was rudely awakened to external consciousness by the loud thud of this horrible Rakshasa body that fell into his ashram. And immediately he spontaneously pronounced a curse, that I curse that whoever has done this horrible thing, who has thrown it here, will die if he ever comes within the boundaries of this particular mountain, Vishwamukha mountain. So, therefore Vali never came in thereafter. And after Vali had driven Sugriv out, Sugriv took refuge of this mountain. So then, Sugriva told Lord Ramachandra, come, I will show you the carcass of that Dundubi, the dead body. It is still there. So they went and they saw, yes, the skeleton was still lying there. So he said, can you kick or can you throw this body the way Vali had done? Because Sugriva was not completely confident that Ram would be able to help him, that Ram was powerful enough to kill Vali. Because Sugriva thought, after all, he is a human being. So how can a human being be more powerful? So Ram understood, he said, yes. And with his toe, he flicked the carcass, the dead body, to a distance of 80 miles, 10 yojanas. Sugriva was impressed, but still not fully convinced. He said, my dear Ram, you see, when Vali threw this body was full of flesh and blood and all the organs and everything was there. And now it's only skeleton and bones. So naturally it's much lighter. So now when you have kicked away the body, there's hardly any weight here. So there must be some other test of your prowess. So alright, here is this tal tree, this palm tree. Let me see you pierce this tree and let the arrow come out the other end. I am sure that when you shoot your arrow at this tree, the tree will split into two pieces. But I want it to come out the other end. So Lord Ram picked up his bow and arrow and he shot it at the first tree. It went neatly, made a hole and went neatly through the first tree, went into the second, through the second, into the third, and in this way there were seven palm trees there. It went through all the seven, it penetrated into the earth, went right down to the lower nether regions, to the lower lokas, and came back up through the earth and went and sat right in the quiver of Lord Ramachandra behind his back. Now Sugriva was really convinced. So these are some of the extraordinary acts that the Lord performs. Who can do such a thing? Who can shoot an arrow in this way and perform an activity like this? When Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in his South India Yatra, he performed a pastime also that is connected to this pastime of Lord Ramachandra. And I will read from Chaitanya Charitamrita Madhya Leela, Chapter 9, Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami's description of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's travels. The Lord next arrived at Dhanush Tirtha, where he took his bath in the river Nirvindhya. He then arrived at Rishyamukha mountain and then went to Dandakaranya. Within the Dandakaranya forest, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu then visited a place called Saptatal. The seven palm trees there were very old, very bulky and very high. And in the purport, Prabhupada says, the name Saptatal is mentioned in the Kishkindha section of the Ramayana and is described in the 11th and 12th chapters of that section, referring to the Valmiki Ramayana here. Next, upon seeing the seven palm trees, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu embraced them. As a result, they all returned to Vaikuntha Loka, the spiritual world. After the seven palm trees had departed for Vaikuntha, everyone was astonished to see that they were gone. The people then began to say, This sannyasi called Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu must be an incarnation of Lord Ramachandra. Only Lord Ramachandra has the power to send 7 palm trees to the spiritual Vaikuntha planets. Eventually, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu arrived at a lake known as Pampa, where he took his bath. He then went to a place called Panchavati, where he rested. All these are places of Lord Ram's pastimes. I'm just trying to see if there is a photo or a painting of Lord Chaitanya embracing those 7 trees. You can perhaps see that. Yes, there is. So those of you after the lecture you want, you can see Mahaprabhu embracing those 7 palm trees that's given in the Chaitanya Charitamrita here. You can take the copy and take a look at that. And also there is a picture of what we discussed the other day, of how Agnidev brought out the real Sita from within the fire, and how it was the Maya Sita that was actually kidnapped by Ravan. So both these paintings are very nice. They are here in the Chaitanya Charitamrita. So after the class, those of you who wish to see these pictures can come and see them here. So I think it is quite late now. We will stop here. And perhaps next year we can talk more about Ramlila. And at every festival we can try to have some discussion. Different devotees can come forward to speak according to the occasion. And in this way our time should be engaged more and more in just hearing and chanting the glories of the Lord. We are here in Vrindavan for that purpose. So we have to be very, very serious about our spiritual progress and advancement, and try to engage as much of our time as possible in service, practical service, in reading, hearing and chanting. So thank you very much for your very patient listening and for your enthusiastic and attentive participation in these lectures and coming here on all the 4 days of the classes. If there are any questions or comments, please be free to say so. The question is whether Vasishtha Muni ate the lamb. No, it is Agastya Muni. Agastya. The question is the Muni eating the lamb. Well, yes, he wanted to kill the demon, Ila and Vatapi. I don't remember which one it was who entered the stomach, but one of them was outside, and he had an arrangement that he would call out the brother, please come, Vatapi, you please come. Who was inside? Ila was inside, Vatapi was outside. So Vatapi said, I will call out for you. When I call out, you tear out the stomach and come. But there was no Vatapi inside. I mean, he was completely digested. So in order for this demoniac brothers to be killed, Agastya Muni, he performed this pastime. What is the significance of Lord Ramachandra worshipping Lord Shiva at Rameshwaram? Actually, this incident is not mentioned in the Valmiki Ramayana. It is not there. But even if it is taken as a fact, there is no contradiction here. Because Lord Ram is playing the role of a human being. He cannot worship himself. And he is here as a human being worshipping for power, for strength. And he is worshipping Lord Shiva. In Ayodhya, he had the deity of Lord Ranganath, of Lord Vishnu, which was traditionally being worshipped. His mother Kausalya was also worshipping. And that is also described in the Valmiki Ramayana, how this worship was going on so nicely. Lord Shiva is the greatest Vaishnava. Vaishnava Nam Yatha Shambhu. He is worshipping the Lord with great devotion, and the Lord also likes to worship his devotees and serve his devotees. It is a reciprocal relationship of love. Because the Lord is eager to find some opportunity to serve and love and worship his devotees. So as a human being, he found the opportunity to do so. And therefore, he worshipped. This is the explanation that we can see. question is that there is a traditional fight between the Shaivites and the Vaishnavites. Those who worship Lord Shiva and those who worship Lord Vishnu are always at loggerheads. It is described that when Lord Nityananda Prabhu went to the south and he saw this fighting, he started laughing. Because neither the Shaivites do not understand who really Lord Shiva is. And they also do not understand who really Lord Vishnu is. And perhaps some of the traditional Vaishnavites, they do not understand who Lord Shiva is also. They do not understand how Lord Shiva is such a great Vaishnava. So therefore the two are always quarrelling. But there is no need. Actually, when one becomes a devotee of Lord Krishna, one appreciates Lord Shiva more and more. So our Shri Goswamis, six Goswamis have glorified Lord Shiva so much. If see Brihad Bhagavatamrita, so much glorification of Lord Shiva is there. The Srimad Bhagavatam also, so much glorification of Lord Shiva. Yes, in Vrindavan of course Lord Shiva has a different mood. He is here as the mood of a gopi, Gopishwar Mahadev. But incidentally, since we are on topic of Lord Shiva, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was in South India, he visited Sri Shaila, which is near Tirupati, which is well known as a place of pilgrimage for Shaivites. And when he went there, Lord Shiva and Parvati Devi, they took the guise of a Brahmana and a Brahmani and gave charity to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And this picture is also here. So you can see these three pictures after the class. Yes. Yes. Dadu has made a good observation that Mahaprabhu is Krishna and Advaita Acharya is an incarnation of Mahavishnu in one aspect and Lord Shiva in another aspect. And Mahaprabhu used to worship Advaita Acharya as his senior. Advaita Acharya used to worship Mahaprabhu as the Supreme Lord. And one time, the incident that Dadu is referring to is there in the Bhagavat, when Mahaprabhu worshipped Advaita Acharya with the mantra, Yosi Sosi, Yaha Asi Saha Asi. You are what you are. And he worshipped him in that way. So in Mahaprabhu's Leela also, and between him and Advaita Acharya, this pastime also sheds more light on this. Thank you for this nice comment. Yes. I beg your pardon, I could not hear you. Vishnu? Vaishnavas do not generally take the prasadam of Lord Shiva. You see, it all depends on the consciousness of the person who is involved. Haridas Thakur says in Harinam Chintamani that one should not accept the food that has been offered to the demigods. He strictly forbids that. Why is that so? Because in that offering, or rather behind that offering, is a conception that this demigod is supreme, which is an offense. So that is not as per the Vaishnava Siddhanta, so we don't take that prasadam. However, the demigods may be offered the prasadam of Lord Vishnu or Lord Krishna. That is followed at Jagannath Puri, right? Jagannath Mahaprasadam is given to all the demigod shrines all over in the temple complex. So if at all we want to serve the demigods in any way, we must see them as representatives of Krishna, as devotees of Krishna, and we must give them Krishna Prasadam. That would be the proper way. Although there is no need for a devotee to independently in any way worship the demigods, but even at some place if there is a need, like in Jagannath temple there is and so on, we offer Krishna Prasadam. And the same logic goes with Lord Shiva. So if we understand and make the offering to Lord Shiva in that spirit, with that understanding and faith of Lord Shiva as a great Vaishnava, as a great Acharya, then that's a different thing. But usually people do not offer to Lord Shiva like that. Yes. Mr. Chaudhary is making an interesting point that in Sri Shailam, they do not directly offer to Lord Shiva. They first offer to Lord Vishnu, and then the prasadam is offered to Lord Shiva. If that's so, it's interesting. I did not know. It's interesting. Any other comment or question? Yes. The question is Vishwamitra Muni a devotee or is just to be considered a mystic yogi? Well, the history of Vishwamitra Muni is long, wonderful history, narrated in the Valmiki Ramayana and other Puranas too. But in very brief, earlier Vishwamitra was a king. By looking at Vasishtha's power, his Brahma Teja, he desired to become a Brahmana, a Brahma Rishi. Finally, with a lot of austerities and yogic practices, he managed to achieve that title. So at that time he was a mystic yogi. So we should understand him as that. The incident of his fall down with Menaka and so on took place at that time, when he was still not perfected in his sadhana and he had not yet become a Brahma Rishi. Even after becoming a Brahma Rishi, Vishwamitra Muni is not renowned as a devotee of the Lord as such. But nevertheless, we can understand that he is very special. Why? Because he was able to participate in the pastimes of the Supreme Lord in such an intimate way. He became the guru of Lord Ram, actually speaking. He taught him many things. He taught him not only Dhanurvidya, he gave him many, many divine missiles, celestial missiles. He also told him many, many things from the Puranas and this way. So, in fact, it was he who arranged for the marriage of Lord Ram. So, although he is known as a mystic yogi, but there is something definitely we can see that the Supreme Lord has chosen him to have such an intimate role in his pastimes, a favorable role. Something for consideration. Okay. So we'll stop here now. Thank you very much. Shri Shri Sita Ram Lakshman Hanuman Ki Jai. Shri Shri Krishna Balaram Ki Jai. Shri Shri Radha Shyam Sundar Ki Jai. Shri Shri Gaur Nitai Ki Jai. Shri La Prabhupada Ki Jai. Nitai Gaur Premanande.